This is the Medicast, October 8th, 2007.
Transmitters? We don't need no stinking transmitters!
This is the Medicast, a podcast for EMS providers by EMS providers, featuring EMS news, products, tips, tricks, and commentary. So grab your gear and glove up. Here's today's show with the Podmedic, Jamie Davis.
Well, good day and welcome to the Medicast, episode 87. I'm Jamie Davis, the Podmedic, and I'd like to welcome all of you to the show today. It is a beautiful October fall day here, and I am really excited. Recently back from the Podcast and Portable Media Expo out in California, and really had a great time, learned a lot about what I want to do and where I want to take the Medicast in the coming year, and set some really good goals for myself. So we'll see how we do on that in the coming months, and I will let you all know as each milestone comes to pass. In the meantime, I want to welcome our listeners, especially our new listeners out there. If you're a brand new listener to the show, take a chance to head on over to the Medicast.com site and check out the website there. I do blog posts during the week of other news and items, as well as show notes with links to everything I talk about in all of the podcasts. And you can find each of those scrolling down the left-hand side in the podcast category for this and also for the Medicast News podcast. If you're a long-term subscriber to the show, welcome back. And I want to thank you again for all of your comments and input and suggestions for the Medicast, all of which is greatly appreciated. Speaking of comments and suggestions, I will use this opportunity to jump right on in to this week's listener email. The first item to pop up on the radar for the email this week is an email that I got actually a few weeks ago from listener Rob, and he mentioned that his 14-year-old daughter is really excited about listening to the show and that she can't wait to become an EMT herself. And I just want to thank her and thank Rob for listening to the show and for keeping in touch and sending back their comments and suggestions, all of which is greatly appreciated. Rob is an EMT instructor, and he has a brand new class that started this fall. And so if any of you guys are listening, I want to thank all of you for checking out the show, and make sure you stay involved and send in your comments and questions here. I'll have all of the contact information available at the end of this podcast. I also got an email from listener Eddie, and listener Eddie is looking at wanting to find out what the average annual salary of an EMTB is, and was just kind of wondering what he's looking for and what he can expect as a 20-year-old just starting out in the EMS field. Well, Eddie, I'll tell you, that varies very much by area, by the region you're in. Some areas pay better than others. However, in some areas, the cost of living is higher. So I think all of that tends to flow a little bit together, although there's some variation in different regions, even in those respects. But I'll tell you, the best source for that is to check out either GEMS.com or Emergency Medical Services magazine over at EMSResponder.com, both of which do surveys on EMS wages, EMS levels of care in different regions of the country by state and in some areas by metropolitan region. So check that out at both of those sites. Just search EMT wages over at those sites and it should bring up the most recent article that they've put out there. But they do that about once a year in each of those magazines, and that'll be the most up-to-date and current information for you. And keep checking back here at the Medicast. You're doing the right thing, staying up on your information, and I'll do the best I can to keep the information flowing here on this end. Thanks for checking in, Eddie. Listener Ted sent in a great video that talks about what to do during the flu season. How do we cover up our mouths? How do we keep from coughing and sneezing all over each other and spreading germs to ourselves, our coworkers, and our patients? And I'll tell you, the best way to do that is demonstrated very well in this video. You can find it yourself over at coughsafe.com/media, or you can check the link in the show notes, and it'll show you how to properly cough. And it's a little tongue-in-cheek and a little bit funny, but it has great information in there about why we shouldn't be covering our mouths with our hands when we cough or sneeze. So check it out. And Ted, thank you very much for sending that email to me with the link in it. I appreciate it. I also got a recent email from listener Sharon in Australia, and Sharon has offered to share us some information on a recent simulation challenge at the on the Gold Coast, competing American and Canadian teams, and she's saying that that is very nearly ready. So I'm looking forward to hearing from Sharon about that and how the different teams did. We'll have to see how that works out, and I'm looking forward to getting her report soon. And I had mentioned that before, which is why I wanted to share this email with you to let you know that it is still on the way. Finally, I have a comment from a good friend of the show, Chris Black, who leaves lots of comments and little gems of information over at the Medicast site, where he comments on the entries over there quite frequently. And this is another great way for you to share information back with me and the other listeners. And this information is there almost immediately. If you've commented before, your comments are posted pretty much immediately by the system. But if you haven't commented before, it may take up to 24 hours because I check through and make sure you're not spamming the site. That you're in a legitimate comment before it gets posted. And that keeps the site cleaned up and doesn't let spammers through the door. But it's an opportunity for you to comment on anything I post over at medicast.com, and you can do just what Chris did. Chris had a comment about a recent post I put up for the recent Medicast news episode last week, midweek, where I talked about a report by the Emergency Nurses Association talking about violent attacks on nurses. And I just wanted to point out that nurses in the emergency departments and other areas of the hospitals are experiencing violent attacks from patients. I think that Chris makes a good comment about the fact that, you know, we put up with a lot in the field and don't have immediate backup around us like a nurse is likely to have at hospitals. And I will point out, though, that in the middle of the night, especially at small rural hospitals like some of the facilities around here, these nurses may be relatively alone. I know one hospital nearby has two emergency room nurses and a doctor on duty after midnight. And so if you're spread out in an emergency room treating different patients, you may be on your own for some time. The security guard is actually stationed at the main entrance at the entire other end of this hospital and would probably take 5 minutes to get down to the emergency department in the event of emergency. So I think that we just need to be aware that all healthcare providers are sometimes at risk for violent acts from patients. Obviously, EMS is on the forefront of that and much more exposed, but I think that this article points out that that is not necessarily always the case, and that especially emergency room nurses are probably next in line as far as healthcare providers go in this situation. And Chris, thanks again, as always, for your excellent comment. That was this week's link of the week, and that means it's time to jump right on into this week's news. Now, I'm going to lead off with two stories that are very much combined, and it's something that we all need to be a little more aware of, especially if you're in some kind of a resort area where people might be swimming in outdoor ponds, lakes, or other natural water features. And these stories are directly related to the Naegleria fowleri amoeba, which inhabits southern lakes, ponds, and other outdoor water features. And these infectious organisms have caused numerous deaths over the last year in Florida and in Texas. And it's something that we all need to be kind of aware of because it seems to be spread over a broader geographic area. I thought it was something we all should probably address. Now, this is not usually a problem in properly chlorinated swimming pools, according to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. But what happens is it enters the human body through the nose and travels from there to the brain. Now, symptoms begin about 1 to 14 days after infection and resemble the flu. However, unlike flu-like symptoms, which resolve over 7 to 10 days, the patient will show a rapid decline in their symptoms and will swiftly progress to coma, begin to have seizure-like activities, and actually will experience a cascade of events leading to the death of parts of the brain. Now, this is something because of its 1 to 14 day infection period that we could have people traveling to Florida, traveling to Texas or other southern parts of the country, and then coming back to your region and presenting with this type of disease. And so I'm going to get back up on my soapbox a little bit here and talk to you again about why it is so important to take a thorough medical history, because prompt treatment might make a difference in the survival of these patients or the long-term prognosis of recovery for these patients. While this infection is almost always fatal, there is a drug cocktail that can be administered to treat these patients if it's identified in time. The problem, of course, being that this is a rare occurrence, and it's rare enough that many doctors may not lead to thinking that this is the cause. And if they go to treat a viral infection, they're not going to be treating this appropriately, and the patient will progress and die. So, what do we do about this? Well, here's your opportunity to get up on a soapbox and talk to the people around you, the other EMS providers, about the vital importance of taking a thorough history. And, you know, when we get to the part of that history that says events leading up to the current illness, you might want to start asking people, as a matter of your routine health history, have you been traveling recently? You know, it's not just for signs of DVT or pulmonary embolism. It's not just for signs of other infectious illnesses. You need to just start getting in the habit of asking people, have you traveled recently? Has your family been anywhere? And this gives you the opportunity when you get to the hospital to make sure that that information gets passed on. If someone has been traveling to a warmer climate and they may have been playing outdoors in open water that is not treated by pool chemicals, you could very likely have a patient that might have this particular illness. So give the doctors the information they need. Now, they might be asking this question as well, but we don't want to be letting people fall through the cracks because somebody else mistaking this type of a history or asking this kind of question. So I want you to read both of these articles, learn a little bit about this. It's not that hard to add to your history taking a quick question about recent travel. Anything in the last, say, 14 to 30 days is probably something that needs to be just jotted down as possibly important. And let the doctors figure it out beyond that. But at least you've tried to get that information into the record and pass that information along. It may mean nothing, but in the case of this particular illness, it could very well save a life by just asking the right question. The next item I found is a little bit of humorous look at teaching people the proper way to do the Heimlich maneuver. For instance, while it might actually save your life, you do not want to perform any kind of choking maneuver on yourself that involves running your vehicle into an embankment. And yet, I found an article where a guy actually was choking on an onion ring while he was driving down the road and began to pass out and veered his vehicle off the road, ran into a tree, and saved his life because it forced the onion ring out of his airway. So I'm thinking, you know, this is probably something that was an urban legend type of thing. And yet I found the link. I have pictures of the accident scene, and it's actually from a recent article that I found in the Wilmington News Journal here locally. So check it out. It's about a 43-year-old New Jersey man who had stopped at a Burger King and gotten a chicken sandwich and onion rings. And as he was driving down the road, he began to choke on one of the onion rings and just blacked out and woke up after his vehicle had struck a tree. He was laying on his side, facing in a different direction, and alive. And he credits the airbag and the impact with dislodging the onion ring. So not necessarily an American Heart Association approved maneuver, but interestingly enough, one that happened to work. So just one of those little quirky things. And next time somebody brings it up, you'll actually have a link to go with it over at this week's Medicast News show notes. Finally, I will wrap up this week's news segment with an article about ADHD and medicating children and the effects or lack of effects thereof. Now, this sometimes is a hotly debated issue among people who don't believe that we need to medicate children for any kind of hyperactivity disorder or attention deficit disorder. And yet there are those parents and educators and medical professionals who have been arguing for a long time that this definitely helps these students experience successful learning and enables them to pass on through the school system in such a way that they are able to achieve their diplomas, achieve their academic goals, and go forward with great success, because they are able to grow into the maturity needed to find other avenues to treat their attention deficit disorder. The two Mayo Clinic studies mentioned in this article are both long-term studies, the first of their kind. They ran for about 18 years, and in that time frame, they showed significant advantage for medicating students with ADD and ADHD. They found that girls and boys left untreated were equally vulnerable to poor school outcomes. They also found that by administering the stimulant doses advised, the students had modest improvements of reading achievement scores and long-term experienced higher graduation rates, greater success in test scoring, and greater improvement as they advanced on to higher education. So what this means is that there are now some strong studies, two different studies, that support the administration of medications to assist patients with ADD and ADHD achieve better learning performance. Previous studies had only shown short-term improvement. These two studies now show that there is a significant long-term improvement in academic scores and ability. Okay, that'll wrap up this week's news. A little bit of a soapbox there from me, but I think it's important for all of us, no matter what our level of care and what our advanced training may or may not be, to make sure that we have the medical facts straight whenever we encounter something like this. And we can deal with the ignorance that sometimes too much information readily available on the internet or other sources can provide. So we need to make sure we're looking for strong, peer-reviewed studies that show scientifically whether there is a correlation of a positive or negative nature in any of these types of studies, instead of relying on just what somebody told the neighbor down the street, or something somebody read on the internet, or some scare tactic that was used to motivate a political agenda. All of these things are not based in real science-based medicine, and that's what we need to be focusing on. And we can be, as sometimes the first medical providers people meet on the street, we can be a positive source for reinforcement that people are doing the right thing, or a positive source for them to seek professional higher grade information from their own physicians and care providers when they may not be doing the right thing. All right, enough of that, me on the soapbox. I will let that wrap up this week's news. Time to jump into this week's tip and trick of the week. And I'm going to jump back into the BLS skills stations for the National Registry Exam. We have quite a few EMTB students listening to the podcast, and I wanted to give them some more information on the skills that they may need to perform during their National Registry test. So I'm going to advise you to use this particular segment as a way to review. It is a perfectly good review for anybody of ALS training because, of course, our BLS skills are assumed, right? So that means we're supposed to know how to do this stuff. So it won't hurt anybody that wants to listen to this next segment. We're going to be covering the use of a traction splint properly in the realm of the National Registry test. Before I do that, though, I want to touch a little bit on BLS skills stations in the National Registry Practical Exam, exactly how they're set up and what you might expect in case you haven't gotten this information off of the National Registry website. By the way, you can go to nremt.org. All of the information that I give you when I talk about these skill stations are readily available over there. You can click through. Sometimes you have to dig a little bit to find out this stuff, but I do have a link to the page where you can download all of the skill sheets, and all this information is easily found there. First of all, the EMT Basic Practical Exam will have six skill stations. The six skill stations are five preset skill stations and then a sixth station that will have a random skill assigned to it. And traction splinting is one of those random skills. The first five stations are, in order, patient assessment and management for trauma, patient assessment and management for a medical patient, cardiac arrest management and use of an AED, spinal immobilization for either a seated or a supine patient, bag valve mask for the apneic patient with a pulse, and then the sixth station is random. And it may include long bone fracture immobilization, joint dislocation immobilization, traction splinting, bleeding control and shock management, upper airway adjuncts and use of suction, mouth-to-mouth, mouth-to-mask with supplemental oxygen, and supplemental oxygen administration. So those last group of skills can be randomly chosen, and one of them will appear there. Now, we've done long bone fracture, we've done joint dislocation, and we've handled bleeding control and shock, and we've touched on oxygen administration and the use of airway adjuncts and suction in past episodes. And so you can look around for that when you search the Medicast website if you're looking for those particular items as well. We've also touched on spinal immobilization for the seated and supine patient as well, because that is also an ALS skill station. So all of these things you can find over at the Medicast website. And we'll touch on traction splinting tonight. But this is just for your information. One of the things I think that people really get bound up about when they go to take one of these practical exams is they get very upset and tense and stressed out over what to expect. And so I think going through these skill stations in a matter of fact, step-by-step manner can help alleviate some of that. The other side of this is, no matter how many times you listen to me tell you what steps you need to do, this will not take the place of you actually practicing with the equipment that you're going to need to know how to use. So it's important for you to get that practice time in. But then, after you've practiced and before the next time you go practice, you can use visualization skills, a lot like professional and Olympic athletes use, to visualize yourself going through the steps that you've learned using the things I'm going to go over in this podcast. And by listening to me tell you what to do next and visualizing yourself doing it, you will actually reinforce that motor memory and create a psychomotor link between the cognitive knowledge of what you know and the practical knowledge of what you've been practicing. And there's lots of science behind that. It's shown to improve athletic skills. It's shown to improve any type of motor skill by practicing and then visualizing it. So let's move on into traction splinting and immobilization now. The first thing you're going to do when you walk into the room is take the offered time to examine the equipment and make sure it's in proper working order. If the equipment is some variety of contraption that you're not familiar with, and there are several different types of traction splints out there, you have the opportunity to have the proper use of it demonstrated to you, or if possible, have a version of the traction splint provided to you. So if you're used to using the Sager traction splint and they have the Hare traction splint, well, you need to ask if they have a Sager splint there for you to use if you're testing away from your normal testing center. And that's important to remember. It also gives you a chance to think about what you're going to walk into. You don't know what that testing station is. It's a random skill station. It's been set up all day, but you're not supposed to be talking to the other students. So you may not know what this station is. This gives you a chance while you're going over and making sure the equipment works to think about the equipment. You have a few minutes to do that. You're allowed to check it over. Once you've done that, you indicate you're ready, and it'll be time to start the assigned skill. First off, you're going to take a deep breath, let it out slowly, and then begin. You'll start off by taking and or verbalizing body substance isolation precautions, scene safety BSI. You're now going to direct an assistant to apply manual stabilization of the injured leg. You may have to initially do this yourself, and then you will be told that you can hand it off to an assistant firefighter who may actually be the preceptor. You'll then direct the application of that manual traction to the injured leg. You're then going to assess motor, sensory, and circulatory function of the injured extremity. You want to assess distal pulse motor and sensory function by checking for a pedal pulse on the lower extremity of the leg. The examiner will now acknowledge that motor, sensory, and circulatory function are present and normal. You will now take the splint and properly prepare and adjust it to a proper length for the patient. You will then position the splint in the proper way next to the injured leg, and you will apply the proximal securing device. On the Hare traction, it's the ischial strap. You will then apply the distal securing device, which is the ankle hitch, which will be used to apply traction. Now you will apply mechanical traction. Once traction has been applied, you will position and secure the support straps in the proper locations on the leg according to the device you're using. You will then, and this is important, reevaluate proximal distal securing devices and reassess motor, sensory, and circulatory function of the injured extremity. This means you're going to make sure the ischial strap is tight, you're going to make sure the ankle hitch is in good position, and you're going to make sure that all the securing straps are properly aligned and in the proper place one more time. And then you reassess pulse, motor, and sensory function of the lower part of the extremity. The examiner will now acknowledge motor, sensory, and circulatory function are present and normal. Now the examiner will ask how he or she would prepare the patient for transport. You will then verbalize securing the torso to the long board to immobilize the hip, and you will verbalize securing the splint to the long board as well to prevent movement of the splint. Once this is done, the test is completed. Important critical criteria that you should keep in mind when doing this test. These are critical fail points that you will automatically fail on if you forget to do them or have this action happen. Loss of traction at any point after it was applied. You did not reassess motor, sensory, or circulatory function in the injured extremity either before or after splinting. The foot was excessively rotated or extended after the splint was applied. You did not secure the ischial strap before taking traction. Final immobilization failed to support the femur or prevent rotation of the injured leg. And this would be in an instance where you didn't have all the straps secured properly. And finally, you secured the leg to the splint before applying traction. Remember, ischial strap, distal strap, traction, then you secure the splint straps. I hope this helps, and it's the test for immobilization of a limb using a traction splint. For the Med of the Week this week, I'm also going to be touching on a BLS medication, but again, I would stress that this can also be considered an ALS drug as well, especially when you have a patient who is hypoglycemic and doesn't necessarily need to have an IV stick. We can manage this hypoglycemia sometimes in a patient that is semi-coherent and doesn't have any other type of carbohydrate around to boost their blood sugar. You can give them oral glucose if you understand that they can manage their own airway at this point. But we're going to touch on hypoglycemia protocols and the use of oral glucose as a medication treatment. Now, I'll start off now with the glucometer protocol. And I do this because I think that a lot of people have been using the glucometer protocol, and it's becoming increasingly used by BLS providers. And you know, heck, why not? I've got a 9-year-old cousin who uses the glucometer for herself all the time, like 4 or 5 times a day. I mean, she's a type 1 juvenile diabetic who is insulin dependent, and she takes her blood sugar all the time. So why the heck not wouldn't anybody be able to learn to use a glucometer? So in the case where you are an EMTB student or an EMTB that is using a glucometer in your protocol, you would first, in any unknown altered mental status patient, check blood sugar before administering any form of sugar to the patient. And this is a change from what was taught to me when I was first an EMTB, because we weren't able to use the glucometer, and we were just told to give it as a matter of routine to any unknown altered mental status patient on the odd chance that they might be hypoglycemic at the time. So this is something that I just want you to be aware of, because I believe that glucometer protocol may expand into the BLS realm in more and more jurisdictions. It just makes sense. It's a simple test. It's really non-invasive, in except for the fact that there's just a small finger stick involved. And you can find out very quickly if it's worth giving somebody oral glucose if you don't have an ALS provider there to do the stick for you. Generally, depending on your protocol, you're looking for a blood sugar that is in normal range. Normal range for most people for blood sugar is between 80 and 100, maybe 110 milligrams per deciliter. And that is the rule of thumb for glucose, blood sugar. Now, some people might say it's 80 to 100. Some people might say it's 70 to 110. I'm just giving you a ballpark here. However, even though 80 is the low end, most blood sugar or glucose treatment protocols draw the line for giving and administering any kind of oral or IV glucose to be 70 or below, or some jurisdictions possibly even 60 and below. So if your blood sugar reading is less than 70, you're going to want to administer oral glucose to this patient if you have oral glucose in your protocol. Now, obviously, if you're an ALS provider, you might want to move on into administering D50, but we're talking about oral glucose and BLS protocol today. You would administer that oral glucose and wait, monitor the patient, make sure they have a patent airway, and continue to monitor them, taking the blood sugar again in about 4 or 5 minutes and see if you notice any improvement. You could then retake the blood sugar and possibly administer more oral glucose if it is indicated at that time. So let's look at the BLS medication, oral glucose. Oral glucose is essentially a sugar paste. It is administered to patients who are experiencing a hypoglycemic or suspected hypoglycemic episode. The indications are altered mental status with a known diabetic history, and unconsciousness of anyone for an unknown reason. Again, I'll refer back to the glucometer protocol. If you have glucometers in your service, you'll want to use and follow your existing protocol before administering this drug. Adverse effects for oral glucose: there are really no clinically significant adverse effects for giving this drug. You want to, however, make sure the patient is has a patent airway or is able to sufficiently maintain their airway. If you are giving it and you are afraid they're not able to maintain their airway, you want to lay them on their side, place the oral glucose on a tongue depressor or a bite stick of some kind, and just press it into the cheek and let it absorb through the oral mucosa, through the cell linings inside the mouth, and have them tipped so that any excess will run forward out of the mouth and not back into the airway. Contraindications for administering this drug? There are really none, except for the worries about maintaining an airway in an unconscious person. Preparations of this drug are usually 10 to 15 grams of glucose in some sort of a paste substance, and that usually means that it's in around a 30-gram tube. So you have 10 to 15 grams mixed with other substances to be about 30 grams in a tube. The dosage for an adult would be 10 to 15 grams of glucose paste between the gum and cheek administered. And for pediatric patients, 10 to 15 grams as well between the cheek and gum. And you may administer this through several doses if necessary to get the administration complete. You'll want to monitor the patient's airway. You want to monitor the patient for return of function. This should happen relatively quickly. I mean, glucose will be absorbed into the body and should start to see signs of the patient coming around within 5 to 10 minutes if this really is a hypoglycemic episode. Unless they've really bottomed out, there should be a way for them to start taking up this glucose pretty quickly. If there is no response, you'll want to treat it as another unknown unconscious issue. You'll, of course, want to monitor airway, frequently assess vital signs, and make sure that the patient does not progress further into unconsciousness, unresponsiveness, or even cardiac arrest. And that is the Med of the Week for this week, oral glucose and the hypoglycemia protocol for BLS providers. And I think that's going to wrap up the show this week. I want to thank everybody for checking out the podcast this week, and I hope the information is valuable to you. If you have any questions, comments, or suggestions, corrections, whatever, you can contact me here at the MedicCast by email at podmedic@mac.com. You can also check out the website at medicast.com, and you can leave comments in any of the postings there. At the bottom of each section of the post, you'll find a comment link. Click that link, go ahead and fill in the information you want to add, comments that you want to leave, and they'll be up there for everybody to see and comment on themselves. It's a great way to lend to the community that is the MedicCast. Of course, you can always reach me on the MedicCast voicemail line at 941-306-3342. That's 941-30-MEDIC. I'll wrap up, as I always do, with some excellent PodSafe music. This week, from the PodSafe Music Network, a band called Edible Red, with their song, Sugar in Spring. If you like the song, let the band know that you enjoy that they've made PodSafe music available for my show and other shows, and let them know you heard it here on the MedicCast. If you like it a lot, you can go ahead to the website at medicast.com for the show notes, and you can actually click the button there. It'll take you right to iTunes, and you can purchase the song there directly if you'd like. I guess I'll wrap up officially now and say, I'm Jamie Davis, the Pod Medic. Until next time, Scene Safety, BSI. Sugar, my friend.